Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. Our first item of business will be approval of the minutes from January 23rd, 2023. Representative Engen, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Engen moves the minutes from January 23rd, 2023. Any questions or amendments? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The minutes from January 23rd are approved. Our only item on the agenda today is a presentation from the Mental Health Legislative Network, their organization, priorities, and their legislative agenda. This is an opportunity for us to get a little bit heads up of what's going to be coming before us. Hopefully, it'll give us some of the base information on some of the bills so that as the bills come forward, we'll be able to make the move a little bit quicker because we have understanding of where they're coming from. So at this point in time, I'd like to welcome the group to the committee. I would ask that as each person is testifying that they please introduce who they are and who they are with. And that as we finish, as each person finishes, we'll take questions at that point in time. If we start running short of time, I'll ask to have all questions held until we get to the end of the presentations. So that's the way we'll move forward. And I will open it up. I'm guessing it's probably going to be Sue Abner Holden starting off, but if you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and start the presentation, please.
Thank you so much, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. Sue Abner Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and Co-Chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. And thank you so much for inviting us to be here today. So the Mental Health Legislative Network is a coalition of over 40 mental health related and substance use disorder related organizations that come together to really put together kind of a package of things that we think will actually help build the mental health system. We are a very strong coalition. We try to reach agreement by consensus and a clearinghouse for public policy issues. And it is co-chaired by myself and by Mental Health Minnesota. One thing I want to say is that this year we decided not to come in with our individual bills, but actually to come in together. So we'll have a series of about 15 bills covering every aspect of the mental health system.
And then next we have.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Shannon Mulvihill, Executive Director of Mental Health Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network, along with Sue. So our first handful of slides is going to be focused a little bit on sort of some backgrounds, setting the stage a little bit, and a little bit about the system and kind of what's working and what might not be before we get into some specific issues that we'd like to tackle. So first, just a little bit about the prevalence of mental illness to begin with. One in five in America do experience a mental illness. And to put that into Minnesota terms, you know, the population of 5.7 million, that's more than 1.1 million people who will experience a mental illness in their lifetime in our state. The number of people who have a serious mental illness are 1 in 25. That's about 10 million U.S. adults, but that's more than 225,000 people in Minnesota who do live with a serious mental health condition. And of all of those chronic mental illnesses, we think it's really important to note that a lot of them develop early on. So more than half start before the age of 14 and three quarters by the age of 24, which is why I think you'll see a pretty heavy focus on children and youth during our presentation. Of course, we also know mental illness is treatable and that people can recover with the right treatment and support. You know, medication is not enough. Often it's looked to as the solution, but it's generally not enough. We need a lot more services and solutions to help people really live their best lives. And so those may include therapy, peer support, exercise, making sure people have stable housing, meaningful activities like employment and school can all help people recover. We also know that people need a variety of different services to get well and stay well. And so that means services across the continuum. So some need access to just basic mental health treatment. Others just need access to some support along the way. Some may need things like case management or care coordination to be able to stay well day to day. And others may need more intensive services like residential services or even hospitalization. So it's so important that we have a continuum of services that we're able to build out and maintain to be able to meet people's needs wherever they are in their recovery. And although there are certainly effective treatments and rehabilitation and things we can do, our current mental health system does fail to respond to the needs of just way too many children, families, and adults. And so what ends up happening, unfortunately, is people end up in a crisis situation before they're able to get any of the help or treatment that they need and frankly deserve. And so that timely access to that array of services is really critical, particularly at this time when we've seen a big impact of the pandemic on mental health. This slide shows a chart of the mental health screenings that we provide at Mental Health Minnesota on our website, just trying to set the stage a little bit for understanding kind of what we've seen happen in the last few years. So you can see there's been a big increase from 2019 to 2022 in the terms of the number of screenings. And to give you a sense, you know, we used to see around 400 or so a month come in, and we regularly see more than 3,000 every single month come in through our website. So that's been a 430% increase since 2019 across the board. It's much higher for those under 18. And so that's gone up about 700% since 2019, the number of screenings that we've seen. And finally, you know, again related to youth, just wanted to point out a few items from the Minnesota Student Survey that is provided by the Department of Education. 29% of students recently reported long-term mental health problems. That is a 6% increase over the last time they did the survey. 11th graders who indicated that they've seriously considered suicide at some point in their life jumped up to 28% in 2022. And there are students who are at particular risk. LGBTQ plus students were three times more likely to report seriously considered suicide and four times more likely to attempt suicide. And so these are just, you know, things to sort of set the stage for our conversation and the real needs we've identified in the system. And so I'll turn it back over to Sue now for some more information about the system.
Awesome. Sue Abderholden, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. So I want to give a little bit of overview of the mental health system. First, I want to just make sure that you know that it's not broken. The reality is it was never built. The state institutions were not a mental health system. And frankly, they weren't all that great. So I think it's important to know that. And most people actually moved out by 1980. So we've had lots of time to really focus on that. I will say that we actually do know what works. We just haven't fully funded it, and we haven't made sure that it's available to all communities and across the state of Minnesota. Some of the barriers that we've seen in terms of not being able to build the system is, first, it's not viewed as healthcare. We had to rely a lot on little grants to provide direct treatment, which, of course, is not how we do the rest of healthcare. We know that private insurance, despite having a mental health parity law, it is not enforced, and families still face narrow networks, services like psychiatric residential treatment facilities not being covered under their insurance, and things like that. Medicaid also discriminates against mental illness, so it does not pay for what we call IMD. It's called the IMD Exclusion Institute for Mental Disease, which means that it won't pay for mental health or substance use disorder treatment in a facility that has more than 16 beds for more than half of the people are being treated for a mental illness or substance use disorder. It's why all of our intensive residential treatment services are 16 beds so that we can actually access Medicaid. So Medicaid doesn't really use, for example, at Anoka Regional Treatment Center, and it's why that most of the mental health community has been opposed to freestanding psychiatric hospitals for that same reason. Medicare also discriminates. I will say they finally, just within the last 2 weeks, President Biden signed a law that actually now allows Medicare to cover licensed marriage and family therapists and licensed professional clinical counselors, which is actually really important for rural Minnesota and in communities of color, because that's where those professionals largely worked and they couldn't get covered by Medicare. So that has changed, but there's also a lifetime limit on the number of inpatient psychiatric bed days under Medicare. This is just kind of a graphic of the mental health system, and I think you can see that we really wanted to put the individual and their family kind of in the beginning there, but also understanding all of the interactions with the rest of the system, you know, with primary care, housing, you know, education or schools, employment, transportation, criminal justice, public health, social services. We have to look at all of that. The intersection is really important. This little chart just kind of shows going from less intensive to more intensive. So certainly outpatient therapy, both for kids and adults, is kind of usually the first step. Then we have more in-home community services, adult rehab, mental health services, children's therapeutic services and supports. We have mobile crisis teams that cover all 87 counties in Minnesota. Just want to make sure people know that. People often don't. And then we have some things that are a little bit more intensive, such as day treatment, partial hospitalization. Then we have residential services, both for adults and children. We call them ERTs in Minnesota. And we also have intensive treatment, foster care, psychiatric residential treatment facilities for children. We also have assertive community treatment teams, which are kind of like hospitals without walls. So really kind of a collaboration of different professionals that really kind of wrap around that person. And then, of course, we have hospitals, and then we have the state hospital. And as you can see, most people are served not in state hospitals, right, but everywhere else in the community, which I think is important, too, when we think about where we direct our resources. We do have a workforce shortage, and it's going to get worse. And so we have some charts just to kind of show that. And you can see this is the chart that says the providers who plan to leave their profession within 5 years, metro versus small town. It's still a lot of people, no matter where you are, that we don't have, you know, the pipeline to actually replace all of those people. So even as we try to invest more dollars in our mental health system, we really have to pay attention to our workforce shortage. I also wanted to just show, and this is a chart from the Department of Health, but you can see just from 2007 to 2014 that we had, you know, over 3,000 people who graduated from grad school but didn't go on to get their license. And that's a huge drop. So those are people that if we can figure out how to get them across the finish line, and you have passed some things, you know, the last 2 years, authored by Representative Vang, that do help. But that's a whole lot of people, again, that are graduating but not becoming licensed. This just shows how many people in our various professions, our mental health clinicians, psychiatrists, and licensed alcohol and drug counselors, their race. And you can see that most of our workforce is white. And we don't have, we have people from other cultures, other races that live in Minnesota, and we need to make sure that we're actually meeting their needs as well. And it is, I think it's pretty abysmal when you look at that chart. And so we really need to make sure, again, that we're able to provide culturally informed and culturally have culturally diverse mental health professionals to care for all of Minnesota. The other thing we just want to kind of talk about is we want people to access care through known doors. We don't necessarily want to keep setting up separate things all over the place, especially for your first step into mental health treatment. So, for example, in some states, they've created what we call crisis centers, where that's where people go to get assessed. But they're largely through the criminal justice system, and we don't want people's entry into mental health care to be the criminal justice system, right? And people don't necessarily know about those things. Everyone knows about the emergency room. They just do. Whether you're a parent of a child or you're an adult or you have an adult family member, everyone knows the emergency room. And that is a normal place for people to go when they're in crisis. What we need to do is make sure that we have psychiatric care in the emergency room. We do have in many of our hospitals separate psychiatric emergency rooms, but you're still coming through that main door because that's what you know. We also think urgent care is a pretty normal door to go through, but we don't really have any urgent cares that actually provide mental health care. And I think with telehealth, you know, we've had urgent care say to us, well, we don't know how many people would come. And it's like, have you ever heard of telehealth? We could be connecting people right through urgent care. And sometimes it's they don't have medication, they ran out, their prescriber isn't around. And so urgent care would be another good thing as well. And then again, you know, we really don't like standalone psychiatric hospitals because our head is connected to the rest of our body. We really want to do more holistic health. And when you talk about people with serious mental illnesses, they often have, you know, comorbid health care conditions, whether it's COPD, diabetes, those kinds of things. So we want to make sure we treat the whole person as well. Actually, President Eisenhower issued the first huge, like, national plan to build our mental health system, and his recommendation was that every single hospital have a psychiatric unit so that people can be served closer to home. We also want to make sure that we're integrating into our current 911 crisis system. We have a mental health crisis system, but you don't put a ton of money into it. And so when people complain that our mobile crisis teams can't respond in the same way that our other first responders, such as police, it's like, well, if you look at the funding for the entire state and you look at the funding for maybe one of our larger cities in terms of their police department, the police departments get a whole lot of money. And so we need to, if we really want our teams to respond, we do need to fund them, and we need to fund them when they're idle, because we want them to be available when someone needs that care. And we obviously don't fund our fire departments that way because we want them to be available if there's a fire in our home. Making sure that our 911 referrals to mobile crisis teams happens. That was Travis's law that you passed. We don't want there to be any wrong door for someone. So whether they call 988 or 911 or the mobile crisis team directly, we want to make sure that the appropriate response goes out. What's happening right now that is confusing to people is we have different cities developing their own crisis teams or embedded social workers, and people are confused about the differences between them. And, you know, our state crisis teams, state-funded crisis teams, are very clear about what kind of professionals are a part of it, what their data collection is, that they have to follow HIPAA. All of those things are a part of it, and we're starting to really confuse people, and we don't really want to do that. And again, trying to go to where people are. When SchoolLinked was developed, what we heard often from families is that they couldn't complete the treatment plans. It was hard to take off of work once a week for 32 weeks. It was hard to find someone. They didn't know kind of how to navigate the system. And transportation, especially in rural Minnesota, could be a huge deal. And so putting SchoolLink, putting the mental health professionals co-locating in the school really eliminated all those barriers, and we've had children be able to access care more. The same is with shelter-linked mental health, right? Why make youth in a shelter try to find that psychiatric care or mental health care that they need? Put the mental health professionals there, and they can connect more easily. Primary care settings, we've seen a lot more embedded mental health professionals in primary care settings to make it easy for people to access that care. That also makes a lot of sense to us. We do a lot of depression screenings in our primary care. And then early childhood mental health consultations, going to where the children are in child care settings where they're struggling, again, to help them and they're in their own milieu. And then being able to go into people's homes so that you can kind of see what's happening. You can help them adapt to things. You can teach them some of the skills to be able to live more independently. And I will say that the pandemic has, frankly, just made things worse. So we could barely meet the needs of people before the pandemic. And, of course, the pandemic has really increased a lot of people's mental health struggles, and not just, frankly, in Minnesota, but around the world. The World Health Organization said depression and anxiety went up 25% around the world. And so we're seeing increased needs, and we're not able to meet them. Providers are struggling financially to actually be able to keep programs going. We've seen programs close. Everyone is facing a workforce shortage, so how do I hire people? We have sometimes, you know, you have both residential and hospitals. They have open beds, but they don't have the staff to actually be able to treat people. And then what we know is that people from diverse communities actually face much greater trauma during this time. While we were all in the same ocean, we were not in the same boat. And so we had people, particularly from BIPOC communities, actually caught COVID at a higher rate, hospitalized at a higher rate, and died at a higher rate. And so we know that there is a lot more trauma that has gone on in those communities, and so it's more important than ever that we build a mental health system that can meet everyone's needs. I feel like I'm talking a lot, sorry. the other thing is again, the lack of culturally diverse providers that you saw in that other shot, slide. And we know that, you know, addressing things, you know, such as poverty, making sure people have stable housing, all of that is really important. We have great disparities in Minnesota in terms of inequality between people, you know, who are black, people who are white, compared to the entire nation. We also know that BIPOC youth, particularly indigenous students, are more likely to be expelled or suspended. That leads to great, frankly, not great outcomes in terms of their health. We know about adverse childhood experiences and the role that they play. And then, again, it's very difficult to find a culturally responsive mental health professional. So that's someone that can really understand what you've gone through, understand, you know, kind of the background, historical trauma, the impact of racism on someone's mental health. You don't want to have to explain that to someone. You want to be able to see someone who really understands it. So we're going to highlight a couple of issues today. One is system and access issues. Next is building the continuum of care, meeting the needs of children and youth, and crisis response and 988. And now you'll get to hear from someone else.
Okay. And who?
Oh, sorry.
Before you leave, just want to double check to see if we do have questions. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, and thank you both for your presentation. And I just wanted to ask about the slide where you have broke out the data of providers by race and cultural specific availability of care. We also called out the increased prevalence of mental health issues around LGBTQ youth. And I'm just curious if you have data around that percentage of how many providers are in the queer community, and are queer young people able to find culturally responsive therapists and doctors?
So after hold it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the Health Department does not collect that data that we're aware of. I think it's a very important piece of this, absolutely. We do have some specific providers, so Rainbow Health, for example, does provide, you know, culturally responsive care to LGBTQ community. We also have Reclaim. You know, there are some organizations. There is actually a provider directory of professionals from the community that people can search on to try to find someone. A hard part is also going to be, are they in their insurance network so that they can afford to see them? We do think that's incredibly important. And when you all passed a bill 2 years ago requiring continuing education for all of our mental health professionals, making sure that we were looking at all underserved communities was absolutely a part of that.
Thank you. Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And Reclaim and Rainbow are both great organizations. I know that there are more, and there are more coming every day. And I would like to explore adding that data to the data that we're collecting around these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I have Representative Edelson. I'm sorry, I'm trying to read my writing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have that problem too. People with dyslexia have really bad handwriting. I'm one of them. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for all of your work. I guess I'm wondering if you know if with the 988 number, do you have, I mean, I realize that this is new. Do you understand, or do you have any idea if it's working, if community members know about it? What are you hearing about it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond to that. We will be talking.
Shanna Melville.
Sorry, Shanna Melville. Thank you, Mr. Chair, member. We have seen an increase in the number of calls. I actually jotted down some data before I came today. Between January and August of last year, there was a 31% increase in calls. A lot of that came after 988 actually launched in July. They saw a big increase in that first couple of weeks even. There's also more than a 600% increase in the online chat for 988. And a 245% increase in texting. And I would say, you know, with the caveat being that I don't know that we've pushed it out as much as we'd like to and intend to. Part of that needs to be about building our capacity to respond in state, because we feel like it's really important to be able to connect folks with crisis services if they really need that level of help. And if those calls are answered in other states, that doesn't happen. And so we've, as advocates, I would say, sort of held back a little bit in terms of pushing it out too much, given that we really want to be able to respond to those calls in state before we push it out a lot.
Thank you. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up. Ms. Mulvihill, do you feel like you're being able to meet the needs right now of the demand that you're getting?
There has been some additional funding that has come in from SAMHSA to support 988. It's not enough. And certainly not enough to be able to meet the demand that we expect is going to continue to grow as we push out that program. And so that's why there is a proposal to add a telecom fee to that, to support that, just like we have a 911 fee. I believe the recommendation is 12 cents per month telecom fee. That raises about $9.8 million a year to support that program, and then pulls that money out of the general fund moving forward, so that will no longer be an expense from the general fund. As a network, we are also supporting a short-term additional investment for 988 to allow us to build that capacity now, because the fee won't start to be collected if passed until January of 24.
Okay. Next, I've got Vice Chair Frederick and then Chair Nord. Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, on the slide that talks about the people in the workforce that are leaving the field, if you could go into more of the details of why that might be.
Yes.
Sue Abderholden.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. Part of it's just aging out. Is actually a huge part of it, especially among psychologists. A lot of them have kept working way past 65 in order to be able to meet the demands in the community.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. talking within members of my community and my county, when it comes to some of these workforce issues, I'm going to quote my County Human Services director the best of my ability here. And he says that their human services workforce is like a family, and that they have a family secret, and that, that they are not doing well. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that put it really clearly in that we are not taking care of the workforce that we have. Mm-hmm. And so it has been my view that it's not simply an area that they're aging out. Mm-hmm. They are getting emotionally exhausted. Some are getting physically beaten on the job. And I don't see anything in this proposal so far or any work that's being done to try to address some of those workplace safety concerns, to make it so it's great that we have a desire to get more people into the field, but if we're asking them to come into the mental health field to a place where they're going to be emotionally burnt out or physically assaulted, then we're just gonna have people leaving the field. So I'm curious on what efforts you are putting in to create safer working conditions.
So Abner Holden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, part of it is making sure that you have enough staff on hand, right? Because we know that a lot of times we had a lot of shortages, you know, whether it's on a hospital unit, a residential facility, things like that. And so people are working overtime, which also stresses them out as well. And so making sure that we actually, you know, have reasonable rates provided to our mental health providers does help them hire more people so that you have more people on staff who can actually address some of the issues. I will say, quite honestly, we are not in favor of some of the bills that would increase the penalties because what we're seeing is people are just ending up in jail, and that's not helping anything either.
Vice Chair Frederick.
I agree with you that more staff can contribute to a safer working environment regardless of the field. But I've also seen spaces where the staffing volume has not impacted safety, and people and staff are still getting sent to the hospital. So I do think that there is space for a conversation where we can look after workers to try to create safer environments for them that is more than just throwing money at it. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Next is Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the follow-up question to the 988, we talked about lack of culturally diverse providers. How are we reaching out to the diverse communities who are going to be using that 988? Do we have the resources? Do we have the tools? What are we doing in that space?
Shannon Mulville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Noor. There has been an ongoing effort from SAMHSA and Vibrant Emotional Health, which is the national provider of 988 services and then contracts out with states and Lifeline centers, to work on just that, in terms of a messaging plan, outreach, promotion of the service to make sure that it is inclusive and really reaches every community who needs that resource.
Thank you. And I will add, I do know that there are some private foundations locally that have started putting out grants specifically for that purpose, for finding people in the African-American community and indigenous community to provide dollars just to help people recruit and get people in. So I know that there's also some things happening from some of the private foundations that they've started in the past year. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the other aspect is the professionals who are going to be responding to that call, because that's the experience that many people are going to be looking forward to if they receive a good experience, because we know the stigma that is associated with mental health. We understand the challenges. So that first experience is key for so many individuals. If we have someone who is more competent to do that work, I think it's going to improve the quality of life for so many people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Not seeing any questions, I have one that will be a little bit harder one. I think this is would be for Sue Abderholden. I will say that I know that we've got a long-term health crisis in terms of finding enough people, and this is impacting every industry. I know that some things came through last year to help to try to address that, helping people get their licensing, paying for supervision, et cetera. I know some places are talking about trying to find funding to pay for their interns. I know that is huge, is when interns have to work for free or doing that type of stuff and try to support a family. It just doesn't work very well. That will help, and it will help keep some of the people that we're losing right now. But I feel it's still going to leave a big hole there What are different things that we're looking at in terms of models of care and those type of things that can take advantage of economies of scale? And I raise that up not only because of the workforce shortage that we're going to be seeing long term, but also because as we're addressing the stigma, I'm seeing that in many communities that stigma is starting to fall, and some populations that have typically not sought services are now starting. So we're going to see more demand too. So as people get more used to that, what are thoughts or what is happening in talking about models of care going forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're right, that's not exactly an easy question to toss out. You know, it isn't like there's one thing. And, you know, and I think, you know, when you look at the all of the bills that the network is putting forward, we tried to kind of take a very holistic view, right, looking at all of those different things and the social determinants of health as well. One of our ideas was actually to look at what Nebraska did. Nebraska actually created kind of an office of mental health workforce and substance use disorder to really look at, you know, are we engaging our youth? Do we hold youth summits to try to get them to understand these are really good careers? Are we, how are we doing in terms of recruiting people from diverse and underserved communities? How are we doing in terms of getting people across the line? So really focusing on that so that there's someone who's tracking the data, reporting on it, which we think, you know, if you measure it, it kind of helps you be able to move forward. I think also making sure that we're going to where people already are also helps. So, you know, having mental health professionals, mental health practitioners in primary care, you know, all of those kinds of things, you know, in the schools, all of that actually really does help because people are comfortable and they know those settings. And I think also kind of beefing up some of our other healthcare professionals to understand mental health. So having pediatric residents, right, pediatricians, work alongside child psychiatrists in a regular clinic so that they can actually learn. So how do I diagnose children? How do I treat them? How do I work with the families to increase their knowledge so that maybe only the really more complex cases go on to a child psychiatrist? Community health workers, they're wonderful. Can we create a certificate program on mental health so we increase their knowledge and their ability to reach out to people as well? And frankly, we don't use peers as much as we could in Minnesota. Both people, you know, adults who live with mental illness and families who have a child or an adult member. We could be using those more too. So I think there is more that we can do, and we've got some bills to help address that this session.
Okay, very good, thank you. Not seeing any further questions, thank you so much for both of you for the work that you're doing and for being here today. And from my understand, next we will have Ginny Palin. If you'd like to come down, introduce yourself, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ginny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and I'll be tag-teaming this next section with my partner, Ani Simons.
Very good. Thank you. Ani, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and then whoever's going to start can go into it.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Ani Simons. I work in government relations at Frederickson and Byron, and I'm representing the Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota. And Ginny's going to start us off.
Go ahead, Ginny Palin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This next slide, we are going to be talking about the system and different access issues, as well as starting to introduce some of the proposals across the Mental Health Legislative Network to start to address some of these in some specific areas. This first slide has quite a bit of information. I'm not going to go through all of it, but just touch on some of the highlights. And really it is that, as Ms. Abderholden and Ms. Mulvihill conveyed, during this time of really heightened need in our mental health and SUD care space, we really still have very limited access to mental health services across Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota, where we just don't have some of the networks in place. And also, as was made pretty clear in the earlier presentation, a lot of access concerns and restrictions for our Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color. Some of these contributing factors are very similar to what were presented earlier. We have a workforce shortage crisis. This is both across our entire system as well as for representing the communities of representing the diverse communities that we are serving. There's also the access of life insurance benefit denials when in instances of death by suicide. There is an ongoing concern about unsustainable reimbursements in our public programs, as well as a still very complicated and often contradicting setup of state regulations and standards that we are, on the provider side, constantly trying to navigate through and make sure that we are providing the best quality of care that we can while trying to comply with an ever-growing mountain of paperwork and compliance factors.
And we're now going to...
Go ahead, Ani Simons.
Thanks, Chair Fisher. We're now going to move into a series of slides, starting to walk through the MHLN package of bills that we're bringing forward together this session. I will just say here, because it's a number of slides, we are, in the interest of time, not planning to walk through every component on each slide of each bill, but we'll be hitting on the highlights and obviously would be more than willing to chat with any of you about any questions you might have or wanting to go in more detail about any of the slides that we talk through. This first MHLN bill we wanted to highlight was our bill focused on equity. As we talked about earlier in the presentation, mental health workforce here in Minnesota is very white and can make it very challenging for a significant portion of our population to find mental health care that is responsive. So we have our legislative proposal here focused on equity that contains a number of ideas of how to try to address this, things such as funding for the grant program that is focused on workforce development of mental health staff from cultural and ethnic minority backgrounds, having funds available for a mental health professional who needs to consult with a culturally responsive provider to best support an individual, as well as things like trying to secure the availability of interpreters when there's a need for intensive mental health services and there's a significant language barrier there.
Jenny Palin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This next set of proposals really does start. It is the Mental Health Legislators Network first kind of plan at the beginning of this session to try to address some of the workforce pipeline and diversity concerns and issues that were raised in the earlier part of the presentation. It starts with, you know, trying to create several new programs that would start to establish that mental health and STD education center to help increase diversity and training opportunities for new professionals that Ms. Abderholden referenced earlier. Seeks to increase funding for mental health professionals' loan forgiveness, provider supervision opportunities so that providers can help fund and be reimbursed for taking on different trainees and up-and-coming professionals into the workforce, and also increasing the funding for culturally diverse professionals so that they might also become supervisors and start to train the next generation of mental health care professionals. Additionally, we are seeking to change some of the current requirements underneath the medical education, under MERC, I apologize, I'm forgetting what the acronym stands for, Medical Education Reimbursement Program, I believe, and really to clarify that training that is happening in community settings or outside of the four walls of a facility or a hospital are also included in that ability to be able to bring in some of those support dollars for that. This proposal also seeks to create some new grant programs allowing mental health professional scholarships so that new folks can get into the field, as well as a youth care professional training program. And would also seek to create a governing board for our peers to help advance peers in this field and industry.
Thank you. Ani Simons, go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Fisher. This next slide represents two different MHLN bills that we are working on, both focused on the issue of reimbursement rates and the impact on workforce and service access. The first of these bills is focused on the more intensive mental health services and increasing access to those, something that we feel is really important to talk about right now as our hospitals really struggle with high demand and inability to discharge individuals to the next appropriate care setting. So this proposal contains a number of different ideas and steps that the legislature can take to try to address this issue. One of them is addressing a long-standing workforce challenge we have in some of these intensive mental health services, where some of these services use a cost-based reimbursement model, which is a retrospective model that can be based on up to 18 months prior. And what this ends up meaning in real life is that when a local provider organization feels they need to hire additional staff to help meet the community need for intensive mental health services, or if they're interested in trying to pass along some level of cost of living increase to hold on to the very valuable staff they already have, that provider has to somehow figure out the way to cash flow those compensation investments for up to 18 months until they're reflected in their rates. And as you can imagine, that can create a really challenging broken cycle where it's hard for these providers to try to move the needle on the workforce shortage. Another example, our state's Minnesota Care health insurance system right now does not cover the room and board costs for when an adult is needing to access intensive residential treatment services, which again creates barriers to those individuals being able to access that care they need when they need it. Additionally, we have psychiatric residential treatment services available here in Minnesota. Those are critical services available for children in a residential setting, a really important part of our service spectrum. And those services have a reimbursement system that is really in need of scheduled adjustments to the rates based on more current economic data to try to increase access and meet the need there. And then the second MHLN bill we're working on related to reimbursement challenges is targeted on the community-based outpatient mental health services. And that legislation is trying to address an issue that those of you who have been around for a while are well aware of, which is just that, put simply, those services have been very challenged for a number of years because the reimbursement rates simply don't cover the cost of providing the service. And so the proposal puts forward a 35% rate increase in the medical assistance reimbursement for those services. And that is a rate increase that would blink off, as the proposal is currently written, upon the implementation of a forthcoming outpatient mental health rate reform proposal. That was something related to legislation passed a few years back.
Jenny Palin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For our last slide, we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the other policy changes and regulation streamlining and updating that we wanted to move forward in pairing with the need to fix rates. We're really also trying to clean up what we believe is unnecessary administrative underbrush, update and align our regulations with today's needs and the standards across our system. We're seeking to remove what we believe are administrative or artificial barriers clients face in accessing care and allowing providers to focus on care delivery to our clients and communities, as opposed to being very much taken away to worry about paperwork compliance. And if I may, to Vice Chair Frederick's points earlier, we understand that this is not necessarily addressing the safety concerns for a lot of our staff and workers, but we also are trying to address the burnout need by clearing up some of the other administration and regulation and conflicting standards that so many of our workers are dealing with in the system today that we hear from our members is really weighing on their ability to do the work. We hear a lot of our therapists saying, I wanted to serve people and provide care, and I spend almost all of my time filling out forms, dotting I's, crossing T's, and checking boxes of assessments and paperwork. And so we're really trying to help remove that piece so that folks can get back to that focus on care. So this is one effort that we're trying to do to address the burnout and keeping our staff to address the workforce challenges. And so with that, this proposal has several different provisions really around trying to update our systems and our programming to offer some flexibility around the workforce staffing crisis, as well as taking away some of those unnecessary, what we believe are unnecessary paperwork pieces. The first proposal in there is for our behavioral health home program. We're really trying to change some of the requirements in staffing to broaden that a bit from requiring a registered nurse to allowing also a licensed practical nurse to fill some of those roles. This is really to keep our programs viable in this workforce shortage, especially in some of our greater Minnesota programs. We'd rather see some flexibility while not compromising quality of care, but we don't want to lose these programs in greater Minnesota because they cannot find a registered nurse to fill some of these positions. We're also seeking to establish consistent application and certification processes and standards across our mental health programs in the state. Really trying to clarify and update some of the requirements within our children's services, looking to simplify documentation requirements, and take some existing tools, specific tools that are codified in statute, take that out of statute so that providers will have the discretion to determine which tools might be best for the client in the situation that they're seeing the client in. Also seeking to simplify the diagnostic assessment, which is the main tool to help folks start to get services, starting with needing to have a diagnosis. We're proposing to remove some artificial timelines in that we believe are creating some regulatory burden and some administrative duplication and not necessarily helping with clinical efficacy. We're also seeking to streamline access for child care by relying, by allowing clinical expertise in eliminating some requirements of some other specific assessments, eliminating some case reviews in certain cases for community clinics. It really, the case reviews are not to say they're not important, but as they've been rolling out, it turns out is more paperwork rather than actually ensuring some of the quality in the care. We're also hoping to ensure that MCO processes for billing are consistent and also aligned with the state fee-for-service process to the best that we can. And seeking to eliminate a secondary certification for some of our services that the counties conduct after the state of Minnesota has already certified some of our programs for community-based settings. And then lastly, seeking to take away some additional training requirements for clinical trainees, because those requirements are already part of the trainees' licensure requirements, and adding them in as they currently are would be duplicative to that process. And so our next section is going to be around the building out the care system, and Mr. Sumad will be the next testifier, but we'd be happy to stand for any questions for this section. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to see both of you ladies here. I appreciate your work. I've got a little bit of a question on, very supportive of loan forgiveness. However, I'm wondering, how are we paying that on the front end, or are we kind of providing the care to, hey, we'll help you pay for your schooling, but I noticed that people are not finishing their schooling. So if you're going to work in the field, let's have you work for a year or two, or maybe even four. I believe that's what we do for medical, other medical services, before getting all of that help, or while they are getting that help for paying for education, so that we've had them commit to the experience. Because as we know, sometimes you start a job and you think, is this what I really want to be doing? But after you've worked in it for a while, you have a little bit better perspective on what it is you're doing and why. But I just, as a suggestion, I think it would help to have, and maybe it's already part of the thought process, but I think it would encourage, I was kind of curious as to why people just didn't finish after going through all that school. What do you, how do you pay for it? A, and B, is there some deterrent to why you would want to work in that field?
Jenny Palin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel. You know, my understanding is that the current structure of the way loan forgiveness works is it is after you've put in a certain amount of time in the field. And so I think our proposals are not necessarily seeking to change that, but are seeking to kind of continue in that current system. And if I may, I think to your second question, there's a lot of, as I'm hearing, a lot of different reasons why folks may not finish their education or move or seek a career in the field. Some of it that we're, if we're going back to some of the earlier conversation, we're having, I think, we're seeing a lot of folks who are especially coming in from our communities of color who are struggling with the way some of our systems are set up for licensure. And we're really looking to find other ways to help them demonstrate that they are competent, very capable, well-suited professionals in the mental health space that doesn't rely on some of the national standardized testing the way our system might be currently set up for a lot of these. And so we think that our understanding is there are a lot of other barriers in the pathway to folks being able to finish their education, become licensed, and then find a position that allows them to really do the work long term.
Okay, thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could understand that, you know, and sometimes someone who doesn't, what would we say, be successful in an academic setting might be your best psychiatrist, counselor. You know, we find often people that struggle in one area end up being much more successful in helping people. So we certainly want to encourage those who provide that. You know, it's one thing to request to have, we're lacking people in working, but we can't mandate it or even fund it if we don't have people. We don't have those bodies. So we can require a lot of things, but not ever get what we need, and certainly that will help. And I think sometimes we're so in intent on getting the perfect person that we miss what we're really looking for. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Not seeing any other hands or questions at this point. Thank you for your testimony and your presentation. And next we will be going on to Abdus Samad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. I thank you so much for being here today, taking the time to present to us. If you'd like to introduce yourself and who you're with, and then start your presentation, please.
Sure. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Abdus Samad, and I'm the Executive Director at Grafton Integrated Health Network. Grafton is a nonprofit children's mental health provider that serves children with complex mental health needs. We have established a psychiatric residential treatment facility, PRTF, in Cold Spring, to specifically meet the needs of children with dual diagnosis of mental health disorders, including autism spectrum, intellectual disability, and other developmental challenges. We are licensed to serve up to 30 children and growing as we become established. We're currently serving 6 children in our program and will be serving ages 8 to 21. Children with complex dual diagnosis need intense behavioral and clinical supports. The PRTF design provides comprehensive team approach that includes intensive therapy services delivered by psychotherapists and behavior analysts, in medical care including psychiatric medication management, and a routine that provides daily therapeutic activities addressing the unique needs of the children that we serve. We do have a high staff-to-client ratio, and that's to assure individualized support for each child that is served in our program. Treatment includes active family engagement through weekly family therapy and education, family visits, and provides other opportunities for families to remain connected with the children while they're in our care. I'd like to share a story of one of our clients who, for this conversation, we'll call him Johnny. He's a 13-year-old boy, loves Harry Potter, loves playing with Legos, loves playing Uno. He's been in and out of residential care for multiple years, largely due to behaviors around self-harm, suicidal ideation, that could manifest in the form of headbanging, choking himself, highly aggressive aggressive behavior towards his parents and families, his foster siblings that are in the home, which resulted in several in and out of inpatient care. Several incidents of abuse until he was adopted at the age of 7 by his current adoptive parents. He lacked severe trust in his caregivers. He spent 30-plus days at the local ER before he was admitted into our program. When he came to us, first he would refuse to meet with his parents, he would refuse to see them, interact with them in any which way, for his adoptive parents. However, since then, our work that we've done with him in the last couple of months, he now engages in weekly family visits, phone calls, they've spent some time in the community going out grabbing lunch and meals and things like that. And the team is now actually discussing his return to his family's home, his local home-based school district, with a lot of community supports in place. Our most critical need preventing us from growing is our frontline staff. They make the greatest impact on our children that we're serving and their treatment outcomes, and they have the highest level of expectations to deliver high-quality care, yet they're expected to do so at the lowest wage levels. We've struggled to maintain effective staffing levels that would allow for rapid program expansion and our ability to serve more children in our program. Our staff require ongoing training and support to continue working with children with high acuity and complex needs. These children are admitted to the PRTF level of care because all other levels of support have either been insufficient in addressing their ongoing needs, or they have simply been exhausted. And given the acuity, most of these children are not eligible for the supports anymore. So PRTFs like Grafton were often the last resort option for these children. Therefore, it is imperative that we offer continued professional development opportunities to our staff to equip them to deliver an excellent service and producing positive treatment outcomes for these children that are in our care. We acknowledge that the PRTF plays a very critical role in the children's continuum of care. It is not, however, a long-term placement option. We believe these children belong in the communities with their national support, and our goal is to have the greatest impact in the shortest time in treatment possible. There's a need for more providers that understand the complexity of these children and support community-based and in-home services. That treatment options on that continuum of care should also include additional levels of care that can provide therapeutic transitions, ensure appropriate support as these children return to the natural communities. This will ensure a stronger community connection and engagement. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. I want to say thank you for coming into Minnesota and opening this facility. I'm not sure if members are aware that Minnesota has the second highest rate of autism in the country, and that rate is disproportionate amongst some of our BIPOC communities. Additionally, I'm not sure if members of the committee are aware that many of the children that we've talked about who are boarding in ERs and sort of getting stuck in our system are children who have a diagnosis of autism and another mental health condition. So first of all, I want to say thank you for coming into our state. One of the questions I have is, where is the facility located? What community?
Abdus Samad.
Cold Spring.
Okay. So
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. So one of my questions and one of the things that I've heard from families is how difficult and how challenging it can be when a child is in a PRFT not near their home. When those services are being provided an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours in some cases, away from the community that we're trying to move kiddos back to and coordinate services with that community and with their families. So for this committee, what kind of suggestions or ideas or things do you think we should be considering to ensure that families have that continuum of care from your organization or others back into their home communities when there is just simply such a distance and we have so few facilities that can meet the needs of these children?
Abdus Samad.
Sure. I think that's a multi-level, it has to be a multi-level approach to the solution. So some of the things that we've heard already from our parents and stakeholders is, of course, the transportation needs. So could there be state-funded, Medicaid-funded transportation companies that are assisting these families in providing transportation, maybe some reimbursement options for gas vouchers and things like that? A lot of our families have reported that due to a variety of reasons, they do not either qualify or they're not aware of those services that might be available. So some of it could also be through case management in the community. As clients are in our care, how are the parents getting that support? So those are some of the options that definitely highlight and jump out.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for your presentation. I don't see any other questions, so we'll move on to our next testifier then. I see that we have Sue Abderholden before us. If you'd like to go ahead and continue with the presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. So now we're going to talk about building that continuum of care. And, you know, we don't really do a great job of that, right? We usually wait till someone actually gets really sick, a danger to themselves or others, before we intervene. Even something like schizophrenia and psychosis, we typically don't provide a lot of services until the person has been committed and hospitalized a number of times. And we don't really do that in any other healthcare issue, right? Early intervention and the appropriate level of treatment is really what helps in all of this. And so we want to make sure that we prevent people from ending up in the hospital when they don't need to be. We really want to make sure they don't end up in our jails or our criminal justice or juvenile justice system unnecessarily. We also know that without housing, it's really difficult for people to recover. And so having affordable, stable housing with supports is really important, especially for adults who live with serious mental illnesses. So what we're looking at is actually increased housing supports. That the HASAMI grants are really an important piece of the mental health system. Also, we have in Minnesota the first episode of psychosis programs, which really is a way to intervene early and intensively, so that instead of waiting until someone is committed and hospitalized, we're really providing that intensive services, including a member of the team who helps that young person get back to school or work. Based on the New York model, we need at least 8 in Minnesota. We only have 4, and so we want to make sure that we increase that funding so that wherever they are in the state of Minnesota, if they need this level of care and support, which is outpatient, that they can actually get it. And we have very good outcomes, and this is studied not just in Minnesota, but actually around the world. And adding to that, the University of Minnesota would like to begin an emerging mood disorder program. So young people who are experiencing very serious depression or bipolar disorder, it's kind of the same idea, right? Get in early with that person, provide the intensive treatment that what they need, so the trajectory of their life doesn't change much. Protected transport is something that you passed. It was an Omni bill many years ago as part of the whole non-emergency medical transportation committee. And unfortunately, hardly anyone's doing it. And this is a great alternative to police transporting people when they're in crisis. And so we know if we raise those rates that we can perhaps get some more providers on board, again, so that we don't have to rely on police when we don't need them. Telephonic care has been really an important piece, especially for adults with serious mental illnesses, especially in, frankly, in some areas you don't have good broadband. And so being able to connect to your therapist by phone when you don't have access to the internet or you don't have the right kind of computers, it really helps as well. And then lastly, the volunteer engagement services. So some of you might remember 3 years ago when we redid the entire Commitment Act, and one of the things we put in there was voluntary engagement. What we hear from families all the time is they say, my loved one is starting to decompensate. Either they're not taking their medications or they're starting, you know, to not work. And they won't go to treatment voluntarily. And what pre-petition screening at the county says, until they're a danger to themselves or others, there's nothing we can do. We can do something. And so what we can do is send someone out, like a peer specialist, mental health practitioner, who can work to develop a relationship with that person and engage them in treatment voluntarily. So just because they say no once doesn't mean that they can't come back. They can go back every day for 90 days, just like homeless outreach workers, right, who go out, they create that relationship to help get the person into housing. We made this permissive, and unfortunately no counties have done it. And we really think this could be a game changer, not just really in kind of helping that person get connected to treatment and services, making sure they have, you know, housing, they have a health plan and things like that, but also for the families, understanding means restriction education, right, so that we don't have things in their house that could actually someone could use to take their own life, making sure they know how to support that person in their recovery as well. So we'd like to actually fund this and study it to see what the outcomes could be. And again, we think this could be a real game changer because we don't intervene early right now. And I'm going to turn this over to Kirsten.
Okay. Any questions on this segment before you not see anything? Thank you, Sue Abderholden. And then next I see we have Kirsten Anderson and looks like Abigail Morgan. If you'd like to introduce yourselves and then go ahead and start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm the executive director of Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of child and family service providers.
Hi, my name is Abigail Morgan. I am a foster mom to a 14-year-old girl in Minnesota, as well as the director at Children's Residential Treatment Center with Volunteers of America.
Awesome. Thank you. And who will start first? Kirsten Anderson, if you'd like to go, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much. As you know, we'll be talking about the specific needs of children and youth because we are in a place of a heightened crisis. We have greater demand for care, more complex needs, and diminished capacity to deliver mental health care to children and families due to the complexities of COVID, due to the rates that are far beneath the cost of deliver care, and a mental health system that's still under construction. We see the crisis with kids boarding in hospital emergency departments, children sent to juvenile detention instead of treatment, boarding in county offices, or kids sent home with no support at all. In this environment, we really appreciate that these priorities are being reflected by the MHLN proposals to break down barriers to care and build the system we urgently need that bears significantly into the children's mental health priorities. With children's brains and bodies growing so fast, early intervention and treatment make a world of difference. And the absence of care can yield true crisis and devastation for children and families. This first slide points to the fact that without community-based services, families are accessing mental health care in crisis and at a hospital. Desperate families sometimes also leave their child at a hospital as the one place they can stay safe and can shift from a mental health crisis to a child protection crisis in a moment. Schools are also striving to be part of the solution and are overwhelmed. In each of these cases, we see heartbreaking evidence of our failure to support children and families, despite all parts of our system doing their best. Again, it's not that our system is broken. It's, as Sue already said, it's not that we haven't built it yet. So what do we do? Break down barriers to care and build the system we urgently need. And similar to my colleagues, I will be kind of hitting the high level because I know that you all can take a look at these priorities. But just wanted to reference many of these items that are before you that will be in our family-centered children's mental health bill that we're so grateful Representative Hansen is carrying are also reflected in the governor's budget. And finally, before we kind of dive in here, this priority list is collected from all the Mental Health Legislative Network members and really reflects those things that we believe we can urgently implement and also reflects what we know works. So a few high priority items. One is to allow young people who are aging out of Youth Act services to maintain their teams as they age into adulthood so they can maintain the same relationships. To the comment about non-emergency medical transportation, that is a critically important service to support young people to have regular access to care, and it just wasn't designed for kids. And so this language will kind of braid together the ability for that care to yield quality and safety for children. We also are focusing on respite care services. These are so critically important for a child and a family to have an opportunity to access respite and really have an opportunity then to dig back into treatment and life together. It makes a hugely critical difference. The next slide includes a number of other priorities, including funding early childhood mental health. You all know that's of critical importance. We're also proposing an enhanced rate for PCAs who are working with children who exhibit higher aggression. So again, trying to be creative and using the tools that we currently have to be able to support families for children to be cared for in their homes. We're also looking to the comments made about children who are spending too much time in the hospital as that very last resort. We want to change the definition of neglect so that parents in that circumstance aren't charged with the CHIPS petition due to their desperation of wanting to have their child cared for in a hospital or truly anywhere. Another item to point to is that adding children to the Transition to the Community initiative, or as it's been called in the past, whatever it takes. So those resources that really allow for some creativity to put the services around the child so they no longer need to be boarding in inappropriate settings, but really can access that treatment. And then finally, we also include a few other high-level things here. Expanding training for family peer specialists. These folks are really some of the secret sauce. They can make all the difference in the world, and they do expand our mental health workforce beautifully. And we need opportunities to give them access to training and to also pay them sufficient wages. We're also looking to fund a children's care coordination benefit that allows for a whole team to come together in whatever intense service array that exists to really collaborate. And you know what it takes to collaborate? Time. People have to have the time to get together and work as a team, and so this would allow for that to happen. And then finally, kind of to the whole theme you've heard in a number of these priorities, we're looking to ask the commissioner to maximize our Medicaid benefits by really taking some time to look at how do we push out as much as we can and deliver services to kids and families with what we currently have in our state Medicaid plan. So with that, we are really so inspired to work with you all to fund our family-centered children's mental health system, and I am very pleased to reintroduce Ms. Abigail Morgan.
Abigail Morgan, if you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for allowing me to be here today and share our story. My name is Abby, and I'm the foster mom to an incredibly loving, empathetic, and resilient 14-year-old girl who I will refer to as Anna due to the sensitivities of this story. As mentioned earlier, I'm also the director at Children's Residential Treatment Center, where I see firsthand the gaps in our mental health system for children and families. In August of 2022, Anna came to live with me after her discharge from a Level 6 facility, the most intensive residential care a youth can access in Minnesota. Anna had been in the system for 7 years following the death of her biological father due to a drug overdose and the incarceration of her biological mother. Separated from her siblings, physically and sexually abused by family members, and given drugs at age 11, Anna has been through the unimaginable. She had bounced from foster home to foster home, was missing and on the run for 6 months before being placed in juvenile detention for what the county called her safety. She transitioned from juvenile detention to a relative's house, only to be left in the same vulnerable position and to be exposed to even further trauma. Anna was then hospitalized for evaluation before being admitted to the residential treatment center that I eventually brought her home from. She was sent to my house with no resources from which to guide her transition to a brand new home. This is because there was not a discharge plan that could meet Anna's immediate needs due to long wait lists and limited community resources. I had the opportunity to help love and give this sweet girl a chance, but I had no idea where to begin. I finally got her into a partial hospitalization program by using my professional knowledge of the mental health system while working full-time and providing 24-hour supervision to Anna. 2 weeks after entering the partial hospitalization program, she was kicked out, which would be the first of many due to an acute behavior problem. The hospital program suggested she go to public school, where she would be even further removed from the resources to meet her complex needs. Yet, I had no choice but to comply, as there were no other options for her. She went to public school for 1 week before she began getting in fights at school, using drugs, and ultimately refusing to go back to the school. I begged for help, but the county social worker told me to continue to do my best, as they had no other supports for her. Hearing multiple providers echo this same sentiment felt dismissive, to say the very least. I truly felt as if I was the only person that cared about Anna's well-being and safety. The county told me to leave her home alone if she refused school while I went to work, as they didn't have other supports for her. One day, Anna called me from home and said she was going to kill herself. I rushed home and took her to the emergency room, where we sat for hours in the waiting room amongst many patients seeking attention for physical medical needs. Eventually, she was admitted to an inpatient psych unit, where she remained for about 30 days. I picked her up, and 8 hours later, we were back in the ER because she had a plan and means to kill herself. The hospital deemed this as behavioral, and I had to refuse their recommendation to bring her home in order to keep her safe. This became a cycle as Anna continued to display acute and life-threatening behaviors at another residential treatment program and then a group home, and the hospital continued to deny her admission. We felt alone and unsupported by the system that was supposed to help us the most. Eventually, the hospital called me and said I had 24 hours to pick her up because they couldn't accommodate her needs. I contacted the ombudsman, the county attorney, and a lawyer. And again, I found myself asking, as a parent, if I'm expected to provide this level of care in my home and the hospital can't, what am I supposed to do? The hospital was threatening to admit Anna to juvenile detention when we got her into a shelter 30 minutes from home instead. I knew this wasn't going to work, but there were no other options, and I wasn't going to allow her to go to detention again. The shelter did not have any of the services Anna needed to stay safe, and on her fourth day at the shelter, I went to visit her. At the end of our visit, she grabbed a glass bottle and slit her wrist in front of me, falling to the ground and screaming my name for help. I grabbed her and held her as she attempted to slit her throat. The staff at the shelter couldn't help, as they weren't licensed to be a hands-on facility. I will always wonder and worry about what may have happened if I was not there to hold Anna that day. An ambulance brought Anna to the hospital to once again be met with the same hostility and unsubtle annoyance with Anna's return. They questioned me as a parent and as a professional and said that I needed to figure out how to keep her safe on my own. My only option was to again refuse the recommendation to bring her home. This was heartbreaking as a parent to leave her there, yet I knew it was the only option that would keep her safe. The hospital referred her to many residentials that denied her, frequently citing workforce shortages and budget cuts as the reasons. She finally was accepted to a PRTF, Northwoods Children's Services, in Duluth, Minnesota. The bad news is that it was a 7-month wait list. I felt more hopeless and wondered to myself, how am I going to keep my child alive for 7 more months? Miraculously, she was accepted before Christmas, and insurance proved to be the next barrier to this treatment center. Anna's insurance doesn't cover PRTF level of care. We were told she'd lose her spot at Northwood if we couldn't pay the almost $600 a day of treatment out of pocket. After hours of calls with insurance and jumping what seemed to be never-ending hurdles, she was admitted to the PRTF. Anna has been there for 3 weeks now, the longest placement she's been able to maintain in 6 months. They are equipped to support her with her intense behaviors, her trauma, and her medication management. I had my first family therapy session with her yesterday, and I got to see the light in her eyes again. I'm getting my Anna back. I took her to the mall for the first time that she's been out in public in 2 months. She was joyful, loving, and most importantly, she was safe. I'm so thankful for our phone calls where she proudly details her success and speaks highly of the staff that take the time to get to know the great person that she is. The road to these life-saving services for Anna has been a dimly lit one at best. Some days I was unsure if she would live to see the next. I'm thankful for the time today that you're taking to learn about the need for improvement in the youth and family mental health system. We must do better for our kids like Anna. If our system can't provide for these kids, who will?
Thank you, Ms. Morgan, for being here today. Thank you for sharing what you have been through. Thank you for your perseverance and for what is happening now for your daughter. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any questions for our testifiers? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Morgan, thank you for sharing your story and honest story. Truly, I think that's how we change policy here. I mean, there's like lists and lists of problems here, right? And I think the stories are what stand out. So, and she's so lucky to have a mom like you. You said you were calling and calling with insurance. Can you tell me how you resolved it?
Yes, thank you for the question.
Go ahead, Ms. Morgan.
So we actually spent hours on, she has a private insurance plan and then has MA to follow as backup, and we had to get the private insurance to deny that PRTF was not the appropriate level for her before MA was able to step in and cover the insurance, but it did take, it delayed her intake by almost 3 weeks.
Representative Edelson.
I want to talk to you after this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions or comments? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for coming here today. And like Representative Edelson said, storytelling changes the world. And so I'm really excited to be carrying this bill and to continue these conversations in this space and with folks like you by our side, because these changes are so desperately needed. And I think the time is up for us to continue just listening to these stories. As legislators and rulemakers, it's our job to hear the stories and turn them into action. So now we know better, and I'm looking forward to doing better. So thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Baker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just couldn't kind of let this slip by without saying thank you. You sound just like a mom who is not only loving, and you're the last hope for that beautiful young girl. Like so many parents are with kids with substance use disorder, mental health challenges, there is sometimes a feeling of complete hopelessness. I don't know how you didn't give up, and I don't know how you didn't do it. And I just, you know, again, I live in Wilmer. We're the home of the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Hospital. We have a severe shortage of workforce, and we can only use half the building. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that our work here, too, will allow us to get more staffing dollars that isn't allocated right now, but we need to do that, and I think that's our plan this year, is to try to get that up, because we're up to 7 kids, which is the most we've ever had, in a beautiful 16-bed facility that's just newly built. We have a few open beds, but we need more folks to help. We've got a great staff out there in Wilmer that are doing their very best, and the PRTF models are a great place for that next step for these kids to go. The system is being built. It's just clunky and slow, and as our friends from NAMI have said, it doesn't move fast enough, nearly fast enough for both kids and adults. So we'll keep at this. These stories are so important, and like all my colleagues have said, those are the stories that change things around here. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Good luck with Anna.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Baker. With that, we will move on to our next testifier. Thank you once again, Ms. Morgan, for your testimony. Shauna Mulville, please go ahead with the next part.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be brief on this one, given that we did touch on 988 earlier in our conversation. Crisis response and 988, of course, are a critical part of our system. Suicide is one of the leading causes of death in Minnesota and has become a public health crisis. Nearly 800 people died last year by suicide. And it is also the second leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 24 as well. With the implementation, of course, of 988, which we discussed earlier, as the new 3-digit number to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, Minnesota does need to build that capacity to respond to those calls. As I noted earlier, it's really critical that we're able to respond to those calls in state, because if they get answered in Texas or Pennsylvania, they don't know our system. We worked hard to build out a mobile crisis system and other crisis services that have really are somewhat unique to the state. I would say a lot of other states are looking at continuing to build out those services, but they don't know that they exist here. And so we need those calls, texts and chats answered here in our state, and so we need to build capacity to do that. In addition, of course, you know, as I noted, we've built out a mobile crisis system and a crisis system, but we are not we don't have enough of it. And so we need to continue to expand that system to be able to meet needs when they happen and respond appropriately. So the recommendations that you'll see here, first, of course, is implementing a 988 helicom surcharge that would support 988 long-term in a sustainable way. And so that is not relying on general fund appropriations past 24, but instead relying upon that telecom fee of 12 cents per month at this point is what we've deemed necessary. We also, as a network, as I noted, have are also advocating for additional funding to be able to build that capacity now, because it will take time to get that fee in place, and we can't wait. We need that system to be working and be able to meet need now. We also are supporting increased state funding for crisis teams and crisis homes to be able to continue to build out capacity for that level of service, and allow flexibility with that funding to allow the teams to meet the needs in their area, knowing that that different counties have different challenges, and being able to assess on their own to decide how that money is best spent. And finally, trying to continue to strengthen those collaborations between crisis teams 988 and 911. I've been involved in many of those conversations over the last year and a half or so, and I really like to think about the no wrong door approach, because it shouldn't matter which number you call. We should be getting people to the level of help and appropriate help that they need and deserve. And if that's a mental health crisis and they're calling 911, they don't need a police officer. They need mental health professional help. So with that, you know, I did note the increase that we've seen in Lifeline calls earlier as a response to a question. I think I just highlight one last statistic, which is about 20% of Lifeline calls in Minnesota are coming from those aged 10 to 24. So again, really emphasizing the need for these services, as well as more support for children and families. So with that, happy to answer any questions that you might have about that area.
Yep, thank you. Taking a look, I believe this is the last part of the presentation. Does anyone have it up? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for highlighting the need that we have in this area. I think crisis response is something that I think we don't know we need it until you need it. I, and like so many people, have been the last person someone talked to before they took their life. And these are the types of services that save people. And like you mentioned, that suicide is the second leading cause of death for youth. And we need to make sure that we are doing our part as the grown-ups in the room to protect these kids and to be there for them. I passed and carried Travis's law last year to make sure that we can dispatch the right mental health crisis intervention teams to these calls in addition to fire and ambulance or police and whatever else is needed. And so I'm really looking forward to continuing this work. I can't wait to sign on and help make sure we can build this system out, whether it's from workforce capacity, license changes, whatever we need to do. I think this is an all hands on deck moment, and I'm really, really grateful that this group is pressing for this. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, thank you so much for
the presentation.
Thank you to all our presenters today, and for all the information. We've got a lot that will be coming before us this coming session. Hopefully this helps prepare us for the bills as they come before us. And with that, I will let the folks know that our next meeting will be Monday, January 30th, and we'll be hearing House File 585 from Representative Claiborne at that point in time. We're still putting together what we'll probably be doing for a week from today. Part of it will depend as to what we're going to see for bills that are coming up. We do have some, it sounds like, that might be hitting the docket and being referred to us within the next few days. So as we know more, we'll get that information to you. With that, we are adjourned.